Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I'm Scott Tenona, a member here. We welcome everybody, regardless of your theology, your religious beliefs, you're an atheist, you're a theist, Buddhist, whatever else, your inclination, you're welcome here. We have no creed. We get to invent ourselves to be what we are. And today's service is partly about how that happens in families as well as in the fellowship. Our speaker today, Amber Venom, is going to be talking to us about relationships and her view on what happens when people get together and do things as individuals together. I would like to draw your attention to the order of service. There are announcements, only one announcement in the order of service, but take a look at that, plus an insert, I guess. For the chalice lighting this morning, I'm going to read a poem by Virginia Satire. I'm not sure that's how to pronounce her name. Connectedness with Self and Others. She is the mother of Amber's field. Allow yourself to become intimately connected with all your parts. So free to have options and to use those options freely and creatively. To know that whatever was in the past was the best we could do, because it represents the best we knew. It represents the best in our consciousness. As we move towards knowing more, being more conscious, then we also become more connected with ourselves. And in connecting with others, we can form connections with others. In connecting with ourselves, we can form connections with others. Our morning's hymn is number 143, Not in Vain, the Distant Beacons. Please stand as you're able and join me in singing hymn number 143. In this fellowship, and many Unitarian Universalist fellowships around the world, we take moments out to share significant moments in our lives, those major events that fill us with grief or with joy. I invite you now to share your own joys and sorrows. If there are any, the microphone will be passed around.
Thank you. Good morning, Kathleen Oldfather, Caring Committee. And just have a few announcements to bring you up to date on a few things. Phil Kermser, who was a founding member of this fellowship, died this week. Yes, I'm glad I announced that. I thought it would be widely known, but not everybody knows. And we will have a memorial service for him this week, Thursday, at noon here. Michael Nelson wrote to me that his mom's, she has leukemia, and they've had a lot of difficulty and keep getting negative results, but just recently have had a little bit of improvement in her blood work. So they feel a little encouraged. He's spending a lot of time with her this summer. Ernie Welty, who is Ruth Welty's dad, Ernie's in Bramlage House now for a while. He's been falling asleep so much during the day. He has lots of problems with that and sleep apnea. But he would appreciate visitors, I think, because it helps him stay awake. And personal note, my own parents who are at Meadowlark have both fallen in the last couple of weeks and both had minor injuries, and they have a lot of dementia, so it's a real challenge to keep them down, not getting up and falling again. So thank you.
Michael Oldfather, I just spent 4.5 days in Tulsa enjoying the weather with 187 other members of the Unitarian Universalist Musicians Network. I just want to say that lots of people are doing wonderful things in their churches and fellowships, and I got lots of ideas, and I've started to recruit new people for the committee so that we can put some of them into place. Delegation is the name of the game. I just want to say that singing with 187 other people who are Unitarians and know how to sing, I got goosebumps right now just remembering what a wonderful experience it was. It was a great week.
Harriet Yonke, we just got back from Tennessee of a reunion of 72 of us. My sister and I were the only one of our generation able to come, and the rest are all descendants. And it's nice to see the young ones taking hold and enjoying our triennial family reunion.
I'm Anna Franklin. I just want to tell you about a joy. Our friend, dear friend, Judy Rowe, is back with us for one Sunday, and she's been visiting for a few days. We're getting a pedicure this afternoon.
Never done that before. But greetings from Maine. I've actually joined the Unitarian Church up there, the fellowship up there. We have about 20 people. If we're lucky, we get about 10. So I always think back, you know, about the fellowship here, and I'm always, we're thinking of you guys, and we're trying.
Sorry that this may take a little time, but we had a new granddaughter born on the 14th of July in Buffalo. It's been known for some 4 or 5 months that the child would be born with Down syndrome, and I believe that's the case, but you never know it in talking with the parents who are so joyful at the birth of the child that life does go on. There are many lessons to be learned from this whole affair, understanding that our daughter certainly was in a tradition to terminate the pregnancy when she knew that it would be born. Lots of medical tests were done, including the DNA. And also her in-laws are Catholic, and they were okay with terminating the pregnancy. So it shows you that across the spectrum, there are many rational thinking people that are involved in these family decisions. And it was our daughter that made the decision to complete the pregnancy, and even though she would have had no moral problem except her own. And she simply said, I can't terminate this life. So just there's a lesson in all of this, that it's truly a family decision and nobody else's business.
Hi, Charlie Kempthorne. June and I are going to Seattle in a couple of weeks by different routes. She's flying out, and I'm working my way out doing workshops in memoir writing. But the purpose of our being in Seattle in a couple of weeks is we're going to have a new granddaughter. And the father is someone many of you will remember. He grew up in this fellowship, Rip, our son Rip. And we're really looking forward to that. And I wanted to say also I'm doing a workshop in memoir writing in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Michael, maybe you know that town. I've never been in that part of the world before in my life, but I'm sorry? In for a treat. Well, it just can't get any better than life in Tulsa, which town I know rather well, too. But anyway, I won't say any more. I just wanted to share that joy with you.
I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm Marissa Larson, and I'm happy to be serving fellowship as the new person that's in charge of selling the grocery coupons. So if you want grocery, check with me.
Hi. I have mixed feelings, of course, about this. We all want peace, and my family especially wants it right now, because my grandson, who joined the Navy, and he went through basic training, and then water orientation, and then down off the coast of Florida, went through 9 weeks, and passed everything, and is learning about the ocean and everything, and now they're going to be on land in Florida and running like the Olympic athletes. And but his father is proud. His father was, my son was in the Air Force, and so he knows a lot about what he's going through. It's for special operations, like the SEALs.
Larry Weaver, I'm responding really to Judy Rowe's comments. Judy, this fellowship, well, I remember a meeting of this fellowship in which there were 11 people present, and we voted 9-0 with 2 abstentions to buy this building. So look at us today and think of where we've been. 7 to 10 people was common on a Sunday back in the late 70s, Judy. So your main congregation has plenty to look forward to.
Thank you for all those joys and sorry. Oh, is there one more? I'm sorry.
I have a joy. My dad is coming back from a deployment for 2 weeks.
Yay. Thank you for sharing all those joys and concerns. For those shared and for those not, let's hold a moment in our hearts. I'd also like to say, if you're new to Unitarian Universalism, this sharing of joys and concerns is a sign of who we are. We are individuals. We have a minister. We have an umbrella organization. But we are who make us up, the people who are here, make this fellowship what it is. We come from different areas and different walks of life. And if you are at all interested in learning more, You can talk to anybody in here, because we can all tell you a little bit something about what we think Unitarian Universalism is. Now, something that is not on the order of service, we have a special treat. The Madrigal Singers are going to sing a Zulu song titled Rain.
Madrigal group decided to do something about the drought. Fall rain, fall rain.
Fall rain, fall rain. Beautiful rain. Don't disturb me, beautiful rain. Fall rain, fall rain. Beautiful rain. Don't disturb me, beautiful rain. Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come. Oh, come to me, beautiful rain. Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come to me, beautiful rain. When the sun says goodnight to the mountain, I am dreaming of the sun say goodnight. When the sun says goodnight to the mountain, I am dreaming of the sun say goodnight. When the sun goes down, the birds on the trees are singing sweet for the night. When the sun goes down, the birds on the trees are singing sweet for the night. Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come to me, beautiful rain. Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come to me, beautiful rain. When the sun goes down, the birds on the trees are singing sweet for the night. When the sun goes down, the birds on the trees are singing sweet for the night. Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come.
Never come.
Oh, come to me, beautiful rain. Oh, come.
Come.
Oh, come.
Come.
Oh, come to me, beautiful rain.
And now, if the kids would like to come up, we're going to have a children's moment. How y'all doing today?
Good.
So we're going to talk about something a little different from what's on the order of service, because I remembered that the Olympics have started. Has anybody been watching the Olympics?
Anybody seen some of it?
Yeah. All right. What do you think is the coolest part about the Olympics? Anybody have any idea? What do you like to see? What do you want to see?
The beach volleyball.
That's a cool one.
Swimming.
Swimming. What else?
Gymnastics.
Gymnastics.
When I go swimming, I go underwater.
That is fantastic. So.
The opening and closing ceremonies.
Track and field.
Track and field. Now.
Javelin.
Cool. So there are all kinds of things that happen at the Olympics. Now, there's some sword fighting, right? You got something else?
When I go to the park at a playground, I go on the swings but I can't go on the monkey bars because I'm too little.
Oh. But you're only 4 years old, and maybe one day you'll do monkey bar swinging in the Olympics. So there's sword fighting, but let me ask a question. Does anybody ever get really hurt? Are they trying to hurt one another when they're doing any of that fencing and stuff? Why not? I mean, it's a sword, right?
Because then they're probably going to get kicked out.
Because then they'd get kicked out, right? Because that's what the rules are, right? The rules are you're not supposed to, there are no points.
If they're trying to hurt each other and they had sharp swords, they might kill each other.
Yeah, they might kill each other. And is that the point of the games? They're called games, right? The Olympic Games. What's the point? To play, to win, to have a competition. Right. So does it feel a lot different if you're playing games with people? Do you feel like a different person if you're playing games and in a competition than if you're fighting?
Yeah.
Why does that feel different? How does it make you feel if you're playing games? You're not feeling violent. I mean, it's happening in a different way, isn't it, right? So some people say one of the wonderful things about the games is that countries who are competing together in something like this, in something like the games, it reminds them that, everybody's similar. We've got all kinds of things in common. We all like to play these same games, these same competitions. We can all join together and do the same sort of thing. And when you play games with other people, it makes it harder to fight with other people. It's a different kind of interaction. And one of the things that adults are going to be talking about once you guys leave is how the way we act together, part of the way we act together makes us who we are. Kind of the people we are depends not just on what we do, but on the things we do with other people. And so that is one of the cool things about the Olympics Games, people think. So when you talk more about when you watch the games and when you think about the games, think about not just the sport, but think about what that means about the world. Right, is that there are people from all over the place coming together and playing together. All right. Go now in peace.
Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you
everywhere, everywhere you may go. We'll now receive the morning's offering. Together we join resources to accomplish good things. The music for the offering is from a Fellini film about five young friends and their relationships. I want us to take a few minutes before Amber starts to talk about values and vision. Unitarian Universalists are proud to say we have no creed, but that's a wonderful thing about us. But it's also a challenging thing. It means that we have to invent ourselves all the time. We have to take opportunities to figure out who we are and to identify who we are. This fellowship has grown enough that we have now the excellent opportunity and the obligation, I think, to be a little more intentional about identifying where we want to go. The board of the fellowship is inviting the fellowship to, by February, take part in a vision-setting process, if you haven't heard about that already. And what's going to be going on is that between now and then, we're going to be doing a lot of talking about what matters to us, about our values, about what we find important. As Ron Knapp described a couple weeks ago, through discussion with others, we discover truths. And he was suggesting that we value the diversity of opinions in Unitarian Universalism, not for its own sake, but for what it can let us do. Our goal is to better understand our collective identity. As the UUA consultant we invited in the spring said, there are a lot of amazing things that are happening at this fellowship, and it's in a great position to be working towards many of our goals. But we'll do better if we harness our efforts by working towards a common, deeper, collectively identified vision. Molly McGoy and Kathy Hedge have gotten very interested in this process, and they're going to say a few more things.
I'm trying to cut my speech because there's been a lot of good sharing already, so if something doesn't make sense, just attribute it to some sentences I just crossed out. I want to take a few minutes to remind each of you that you are in a relationship with me, whether you intended to be or not, by attending and being possibly a member of this fellowship, we are connected. My actions impact you, and your actions impact me. True stewardship begins with protecting what is good. How can I know if my actions as a volunteer here are protecting what is good? By talking and listening and listening and talking and listening about what we care about. Like a marriage, a family, or a friendship, our relationship requires communication. If you have ever once said about this place that the you should just, or someone needs to, or we really need better, then you should engage in this conversation about what you value. About what you value, like, and love first. We all need to know each other better. You do not build a friendship by setting strict rules of behavior and expectations for return compensation. You do not improve a marriage through constant criticism of your spouse. And if you're doing that, please stop. We cannot strengthen this fellowship based on things we could change. One of the things I embrace about our fellowship, as Scott was just touching on it, is the ability to openly express opinions. But, in my opinion, that can minimize celebrating what is good or reveling in an accomplishment. And it makes having a conversation about what we care about a little more difficult. In my office and my professional work at undergraduate admissions at K-State, we have staff assigned to specific geographic regions, student types, jurisdictions, responsibilities, operations, all kinds of stuff. This can lead to siloing, disjointed efforts, tripping each other up, and plain old hurt feelings. There's a lot of people involved. We counter that by putting a team above the individual and our mission above the team. And I've found that working in this environment for a number of years has changed the way I approach my personal life, and that Rob and I are crafting our lives in a different and intentional way. And my example of this is, 3 years ago, we bought an ugly house in an odd neighborhood. Intentionally. Why? Because we wanted to. I wanted to be able to walk Nick to school. I grew up in a very small town, and that was very important to me, and I had a specific time frame that I wanted to make this move before Nick started school. Rob wanted some more square footage, and he was looking at a particular elementary school, and we weren't looking for perfection. We agreed on the things that were important to us, and then all other considerations fell by the wayside. The total lack of curb appeal aside of our house, it is a wonderful home, and we knew there'd be projects, and we're not handy, and we have to pace ourselves and prioritize. But aside from a very low point regarding choosing a countertop that lasted weeks and was very painful, we are leagues happier now than we were when we were in a much more typical family home and neighborhood. In the coming months, this fellowship will be talking as a community, and these talks could lead to great things. There should be no winners and losers, but a deeper understanding of one another and a cooperative spirit to future endeavors. Listen. Apply yourself to being part of something bigger, and sacrifices will be given willingly. We will be crafting this community together. So, my charge to you is to embrace a positive fellowship self-image. You have given me a place to serve, a place ingrained in my son's identity, and a place where my atheist husband is a point of pride. So in acknowledging what you mean to me, I say to you as a fellowship and individuals, you are changing, you are beautiful, you are healthy, you are strong, you are kind, you are smart, and you are funny. I'm glad you are a part of my life, and I look forward to getting to know you better.
Thank you. Whenever you walk into a room, you bring with you your personality, your experiences, your uniqueness, and it's a gift that you give to all of us, even if this is the first and only time you've come through those doors right there. So what we'd like to do is take a short moment to celebrate those gifts and to share them with each other. So would you please take about 15 seconds to think in silence about one quality that makes you, you? I'm watching the clock. And we get one. Look at all those bright ideas out there. All right. Would you please now greet your neighbors and as many people as you can, tell them that one special thing about you. I'm going to give you 1 minute. Five, four, three, two, one. Eyes up this way. Please raise up your finger. How many people did you get to talk to?
I had five.
Five, two, five, five, four, four, four. Okay, excellent. Thank you so much. You know, really one of the best things about talking to each other is that we get to talk about what matters to us most, and we get to know such very interesting people. And the other thing is that we get to learn so much more about people that we thought we already knew. And so with this vision, this walk towards a common vision, one thing we know for sure first is that it's not a final vision, that it'll continue changing as we go through the years. And it'll change as our community's needs change, and we're going to decide that together and not in isolation. But one thing we know for sure is if we don't know where we're going, how will we know when we get there? So, but I propose that we travel together, and the journey is going to be delightful. Thank you.
Good morning. I really like strengths-based activities, so that was really fun for me. I am a marriage assistant professor of marriage and family therapy here at K-State. And when I say marriage, I mean, for me, committed partnership. And when I say family, I am thinking of the people who are dear to you, that in times of need that you can rely on and who rely on you. And I would like to start my talk with a quote from the Dalai Lama, a very wise man, and it's about relationships. He said, consider the following. We humans are social beings. We come into the world as the result of others' actions. We survive here in dependence on others. Whether we like it or not, there is hardly a moment of our lives when we do not benefit from others' activities. For this reason, it is hardly surprising that most of our happiness arises in the context of our relationship with others. I was drawn to both my field of marriage and family therapy and Unitarian Universalism, in part because of their shared understanding of the interconnectedness of all things and the inherent worth of all people. I think there is great power in that interconnectedness, the power to create change in the world through our relationships with ourselves and with each other. It is how we use that power that is up to us. The field of family therapy evolved, I imagine, in much the same way that many of us found Unitarian Universalism. That we just didn't fit where we were anymore, and we were seeking a better fit. Family therapists were social workers, psychologists, communication specialists, psychiatrists. They were all coming to conclusions about human systems that challenged the way their field viewed things. And they came together from all these different fields to create a new way of viewing how human beings interacted and the importance of those interactions. System theory serves as the foundation of my field. The term systems theory was coined in the 1930s, by a biologist. And he proposed this then quite zany notion, I'm sure, that parts come together to form a whole that is greater than the sum of their parts. And when we think about that, what does that mean? So my body is a bunch of organs. If I take all those organs and I put them in a box, that is not a human, that is not me. It is how those organs interact with each other that create me, that create a human, how they communicate with themselves, how they are in relationship, how my body is in relationship with the world around me. Just as this congregation is more than just a group of people sitting in a room, it is the relationship that you all have with each other, how you communicate to each other, that creates the sense of community, that creates the sense of a culture where I get to feel like I fit and come every Sunday and feel that fitness for me. Further, all systems are subsystems of larger systems. So my organs are subsystems of my whole body. My body, who I am, is a subsystem of my family. My family is a subsystem of this congregation. This congregation is a subsystem of the Manhattan community, of the Unitarian Universalist community in the world. Our community in Manhattan is a subsystem of the larger American community, and out and out and out. But these relationships, these interconnectedness, are not only vertical, they're also horizontal and all around us, that we all belong to many multiple subsystems that connect with each other. So I am also a member of my program at school. My program is a subsystem of the department, which is a subsystem of the college, which is a subsystem of the university. But these subsystems overlap. There are other people besides me here that come from some of those subsystems. And that interconnectedness is what allows for great change to occur from simple actions. I was thinking about that, and I don't know why, but Rosa Parks popped into my head. And I remember learning about Rosa Parks and how one day in the 50s, she had had a long day at work, and she took a seat on a bus. And the bus driver, when a white person came on, suggested that she give up her seat. And in that moment, she made a choice. She made a choice not to participate in a system that devalued her. She made a choice to value herself. And that choice created ripples that joined with other ripples around the country to change our very culture and how we view relationships between races and between each other and difference. That one small action was not so small after all. Both flexibility and structure are necessary for systems to function well. So if we think of that kind of as a continuum, so on one end of the continuum we have a really, 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 really flexible system without much structure. And you tend to feel those systems are very chaotic. You feel chaos in those systems. On the other end of the continuum, we have lots and lots of structure, but not much flexibility. And here we feel rigidity, we feel stuckness, we feel kind of trapped. Systems at both ends of the spectrum are barely surviving. On this end of the spectrum, there is so much flexibility that there is not quite enough glue to hold that system together. On the other end of the spectrum, we have so much glue that the parts cannot adapt. They feel they cannot adapt to changing situations and circumstances. So we look for that balance in the middle, that structure that is enough glue to hold us together, and enough flexibility that allows us to adapt to changing circumstances and to the world around us and to create change. As we move throughout the day, we receive many pieces of information from the systems that we are a part of. Sometimes that information suggests that we need to make a change. Sometimes that information suggests that we need to stay the same. Both messages can be just fine. The struggle comes in when we repress who we are for the sake of a larger system. When we devalue ourselves for the sake of the system we are a part of to make the system more functional. To cope in those situations, we adopt ways of interacting to protect ourselves, such as blaming or placating, demeaning, or avoiding. We're trying to protect ourselves in those relationships. Because it's some part of us we don't want to be devalued. Virginia Satir was a social worker who joined the family therapy movement quite early on, and we consider her one of our founders. She believed that the biggest obstacle to personal, interpersonal, and international peace was that people do not know how to perceive and accept their equality of value. She viewed this as the social rationale for the cultural acceptance of power differentials in our society and our relationships. Satir believed that these power differentials deny people the ability to be whole by giving people the message that they do not fit. She called these systems hierarchical systems, which limited people's freedoms. These systems have not balanced structure with flexibility. Satir endorsed 5 different freedoms. The freedom to see and hear what is instead of what should be, was, or will be. The freedom to feel what you feel instead of what you ought to feel. Sometimes we get the message that we should feel a certain way. She says we need to have that freedom to feel what we really feel. The freedom to say what you think instead of what you should think. The freedom to ask for what you want instead of always waiting for permission. And the freedom to take risks on your own behalf instead of choosing to always be secure. Humans are quite phenomenal creatures, and our brains are quite phenomenal. We search to make meaning out of everyday interactions. We grow up, we are born into this world, we begin making meaning right from the beginning. We are born into an environment. We are born into a family with all the varieties that that word encompasses. That family, a culture, a larger social, economic, and religious culture that that is embedded in. And we cope the best we know how. Sometimes the messages we get fit us, and they're congruent with who we are, and sometimes they don't. We take the learning and coping style that we have adapted from these relationships into future relationships. The messages we learn from the culture around us tell us what it means to be a human, to love, to express that love, and to be ourselves. They give us messages about who we are, if we fit or if we don't, and what parts of us may fit and what parts of us may not. And when we take that learning into future systems, we end up being drawn towards people who had similar learning to ours. If we were in a hierarchical system growing up, or possibly if the society's system is hierarchical, we get that message that there's only one right way. And we were drawn to other people who had that similar learning, because to us that might be the only right way that has been taught to us. This is the only way to be. And then we often find ourselves in a similar situation time and time again. When I was growing up, my family system was abusive. They've come a long way since then and are no longer, but that was a hierarchical system. And coming out of that system, I ended up, try as I might, I still ended up in abusive relationships over and over again. And I tried to make those changes, and I tried to say, but I'm trying to follow the rules of what I thought a relationship was, what I was taught, and somehow it keeps not working out. And it was very frustrating. Until I got to the place where I realized that, it just dawned on me that this must not be the only way. I am sacrificing so much of myself in these relationships that this can't be the only way there is. And that allowed me the freedom to get out of that pattern, to recognize it for what it was, that it was one option, but it didn't have to be my option, that I could do differently, that I could be different in relationships and develop a different definition of what it means to be myself in a relationship with other people. Satir suggests that how we make meaning of the world can be assessed from 4 different aspects: how we define a relationship, how we define a person, how we explain an event, and our attitudes towards change. In a hierarchical model, relationships exist in only one variety. Someone is dominant and someone is submissive. Someone is fitting and someone is not fitting. Someone is valued and someone is valued less. In these types of relationships, we risk overlooking the inherent worth and dignity of every person. In a hierarchical model, we measure ourselves by something external. If it does not fit who we are, then we do not fit. It is a very challenging task to set aside these expectations of others without rebellion and to find ourselves. Satir suggests we start by noticing that nobody is exactly like us. And we've all heard that speech, that everybody is unique. But what does that really mean? What does that really mean for our day-to-day interactions with people and our day-to-day view of the world? So if I'm driving in traffic and someone cuts me off, I may think, because I got scared and I'm a little angry now, that they're an SOB and they shouldn't be on the road, and what right did they have to cut me off? That may happen, I'm just saying. But I could also choose from a systemic view to view them as a person in context of equal value to me. That although they did something that was dangerous, perhaps it was because they simply did not see me, and they're human, and there are things that I don't see regularly as well, and therefore we are equal. It may also be that they're a teenager whose, you know, parents just kicked them out in a drunken rage, and they're trying to get to safety. It could be a single mom who, you know, can't be late for work one more day or they'll lose their job, but their kid is sick and they need to take them to the hospital as quick as they can. We don't know. But when we jump to the conclusion that someone else is less than us, we tend to act differently than when we jump to the conclusion that they're equal to us. And maybe they're just in a different context. Maybe there's different explanations. Maybe they're in a different stage of growth. But that their value is equal to our value. In a hierarchical model, events are explained linearly. A causes B, which causes C. There's only one right way to look at reality in this hierarchical model. But if we view things systemically, we recognize that we mutually influence each other and acknowledge the interactional relationship between and among events and the context in which they occur. So let's say that I wake up and Drew has forgotten to take out the trash. My loving husband has forgotten to take out the trash. And if I operate from my hierarchical system model training that I grew up in, I might say, well, he was just being passive aggressive and trying to get back at me for not doing the dishes last night. That may be so, but if that is so, what is it in our relationship that is kind of blocking us from being able to connect and communicate more directly with each other rather than having to be passive aggressive? And it may also be that context is important. Maybe his alarm didn't go off and he was late for a meeting and simply forgot. But if I go into an interaction with him with a preconceived notion that A equals B equals C, then I will get out of that interaction exactly what I suspected, that we are fighting, that this is a disagreement, that it's me versus him. But if I go into that interaction with my explorer cap on and go in saying, what's happening here? You know, you forgot to take out the trash. I was just curious what was happening. I'm likely to get a very different response than if I go in with my defenses up, ready to guard against an attack that I think is happening. I'm not saying that ever happens. I'm just saying. So if we assume that A to B, that linear causality, we will likely behave in a way that perpetuates the very problem we are trying to alleviate. From a systemic view, behavior becomes an interrelation among what is happening in the world around us, as well as what is happening between us and within us. What do I bring to that relationship? Influences the relationship we create between us. Change then becomes about the process of interactions and the pattern we notice in our relationships that can tell us something about ourselves. People who work from a hierarchical framework consider change undesirable. Keeping the current order intact is a way of feeling safe. But it also means that people cannot move forward and grow. Sometimes from this framework, the familiar not functioning is safer, is less threatening than the unknown possibility for function. That unknown is scarier than the known, even if the known is hurting us. Unfortunately, change is inevitable, and try as we might to stop the clock, I get older, and our parents get older, and our children grow up, and people die, and the world changes. Fear of the unknown is normal, and all of us have it. But it is the balance of structure and flexibility, the periods of growth and the periods of stability, that can help create our security. Security and trust in that instance then become based on our confidence in our own ability to cope with change and the ability of our relationships to be strong enough to handle that change, that challenge, that growth. Simply because something is familiar doesn't mean that it's safe. Fortunately, being influenced by systems also means that we have the power to influence them. Like a drop that started the ripple, changing our own beliefs and behaviors creates systemic change. Change in any subsystem necessarily changes the larger system. The tricky part of changing is changing in the face of the messages that say not to. Those messages that say, don't change, don't rock the boat, you're going to make ripples, and we don't know if we can cope with this change. And that is hard. For example, the voice of those who believe in marriage equality started out small, and it was met with resistance and fear and violence. But those voices did not diminish in the face of adversity. They held firm and they grew. And when I hear people say that, you know, marriage equality is going to result in people marrying goats or inanimate objects, or when I hear those kinds of statements, I hear a hierarchy afraid of change, uncertain of their own selves, who have had to cope using defensive maneuvers that are stifling their ability to grow. With ourselves, in our personal relationships, in our congregation, with our neighbors, at work, we can practice every day justice, equity, and compassion in our human relations. We can make ripples by responding differently from a place of security in ourselves and security in our relationships, embracing all that we are to increase the ability of ourselves, our relationships, our congregation, and community to bend instead of breaking, to create a vision, and to create ever-increasing ripples. And I would like to end with a meditation by Virginia Satir. And I don't know how to meditate, so you can do whatever you would like to while I'm reading it. This is called Developing Your Self-Esteem Maintenance Kit. Now, at this point, I would like to give you your self-esteem maintenance kit, which I hope you will receive, accept, and become familiar with using. The first thing in this kit is a detective hat, which you put on immediately when there is a puzzle or a question or an effort to understand. To understand, how do these pieces fit together? How do you explore for the gaps and find the things that fit? This is in contrast to judging. Many people judge before they explore, but I would like to recommend to you that you keep your detective hat handy for any time a question, puzzle, or gap appears, so that you can go on a journey of exploration. The second thing in your kit is a medallion that you can hang around your neck. On one side, in beautiful jeweled letters, it says yes. Underneath that yes, it says, thank you for noticing me. What you ask of me at this time fits just fine. The answer is yes. And on the other side, in equally beautiful jeweled letters, is the word no. Underneath that it says, thank you for noticing me. What you ask of me at this time doesn't fit at all. The answer is no. This is the key to your integrity. Yes and no are both loving words. When you say yes and you feel no, or when you say no and you feel yes, you have eroded your integrity and weakened yourself. So keep your medallion fresh within your awareness and always say the real yes and the real no, keeping your integrity intact and keeping your strength strong. The next thing in this kit is an empowering wand, a courage stick, a wishing wand. It is all three. And when you feel a wish or a desire to move in a direction, you can take this empowering wand in your hand and move, dragging your fears behind you. If you wait until all your fears are taken care of, you will probably never move ahead. As you take that empowering wand, wishing wand, courage stick, in your hand and move forward, many times your fear will have been dissolved by the time you reach where it is that you want to go. And to take this wand and use it to empower yourself means that you use yourself as a reference. Does this fit? Where is it that I want to go? You are the one who sees your vision. No one else can see it for you. And many people, not knowing your vision, not understanding it, will try to dissuade you because they think that you will be hurt. Many people do not trust going into the unknown, but with your vision and hope to guide you, you can move there. The growth in all of us is strong and wants to have continuing new expressions. And so you're giving yourself permission to move in the direction of your visions, of your dreams, of your hopes, and your wishes is what brings you to new growth levels. The next thing in the kit is a golden key. The golden key enables you to open any door, to ask any question, to make speakable what is unspeakable, to attempt the undoable and make it doable, opening up the possibilities, looking in all the cracks, noticing even the smallest kind of movement. That's your golden key. The next thing in the kit is a wisdom box. The wisdom box is part of your heritage. It's part of what you came into this world with. And for me, I have located it by going into my navel 2 inches and going up towards my heart. Halfway between, I find the wisdom box. The wisdom box is in contact with all the wisdom of the universe, all the wisdom of the past, and all that which resides in you. It is that part which you sense something giving direction. It is that part deep inside that knows and tries to give you direction. Like a thought or a feeling, you will not find it on a surgery table, but I do not doubt the existence of it. It is that part of us, when we are cleared of all of our defenses and all of our fears, in which we can hear the stirrings of our growth and of our wisdom. Perhaps our greatest job in life is to remove all that stands between ourselves and our wisdom, and then to recognize that all human beings have a wisdom box. It needs only to be tapped. As you make more use of your wisdom box and all of your tools, you can go into your psychological closet to examine what is there for you, what you need right now. And you may find that there are things there that came about as a result of your saying yes when you felt no, which might include anger, rage, or resentment. Or you may find things there that have said to you in the past, you don't deserve to go further, you have done bad things. But you will recognize this for what it is, a misunderstanding of you and yourself. And as you clear your closet of these things by sorting them, by noticing them, and by letting them go, you can make room for new things that come as a result of the new ways of viewing yourself. So this morning, as you come into this day, give yourself permission to know that your underpinnings are solid, that you are a wonderful, magnificent being of this universe, and you have only to learn about that magnificence. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for discussion now. If anybody wants to share a little bit, let's join into a community. Let's explore our relationships. Find one of those toolkit pieces and share something.
Great talk. One thing I find when I read stuff like Christopher Hedges in particular is when he's talking about the upsurge in fundamental Christianity, one of the huge issues of that, of course, is the reassertion that the patriarchy hierarchical order is what is needed to save our country from all of these bad things that we're going through. So if the men had more power and the women would just be quiet And gays and lesbians and blacks and Chinese and Asian Americans and the Hispanics would just all go away, we'd be a fine place. So I don't know if you're up to addressing that, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on how those of us who don't see the world in a definite up-down pattern, but a more horizontal approach to life, can interact with some of these people. Because I've been walking precincts for the past 2 weeks, and you just can't rationalize with some of these people. It's just, you know, by God, it's going to be the way I tell you, and shut up and get out of my way. And I don't find that as a way of solving our problems.
Yeah, it is very challenging to sometimes to explore in conversation with people who are kind of set in their ways. I think because exploration would then be threatening in that circumstance. As a therapist, I can answer how I manage that in therapy. Probably some of you have found ways of managing that as well. For me, I often talk to those people who I interpret as being in a more maybe fearful place, in an honoring way. For me, I ask them questions and try and validate their experiences without validating the message that they're sending. And that tends to bring their defenses down a little bit. But there are probably many ways to approach those situations. What else have y'all found works?
Courtney Albin. This kind of not quite answering your question, but adding a little bit to what his comment was, you mentioned that your family that you grew up in, or your you know, when you were younger, had a history, and that they have changed. And I was wondering if you could embellish on how they actually did that.
Yeah. So my family has an intergenerational history of abuse and alcoholism. It's been transmitted through generations. But I also see great resiliency in my family. Each generation has tried to do something different. Just in their efforts to try and do something different, they ended up doing something the same. And when I was in college, really it came to a head that my family kind of fell apart. My role in my family was to be the glue. I was the glue. I was the oldest child. I was the self-esteem for my mom, and my dad wasn't around very much. And when I left, they kind of fell apart. And from that falling apart, I saw those resiliency pieces come out in both of my parents that allowed them to kind of sit in that rubble and say, you know, something different has to happen. And they began to grow and to change and to examine themselves. But it took that falling down to start that process of building up. And as I grew in my distance from them, as I kind of reclaimed myself, it was during college that I realized that this abusive system was something that was happening, that I was replicating, and that I had a power to stop. As I made choices in my relationships to respond differently, sort of their interactions with me had to change in order for them to stay connected with me, that side of it. But they also recognized for themselves that they wanted something different, and they started making changes. And now they function quite well. So I'm very proud of my family and the resilience that they had and being able to do that. They're divorced, but they're functioning happily apart from each other. They're functioning happily apart from each other. Oh.
Wonderful talk, thank you. Gives me a lot to think about. And in response to Chris, I think going in your experience, going door to door, it's almost impossible to rectify or come to some common ground in a very brief interaction with people. But I know that my husband and I have lived more than 30 years next to a very fundamentalist family, and every conversation we used to ever have with the husband ended up, he would turn it into a debate about religion. but over the years, I mean, this has taken many years, they're actually very dear to me, despite them telling me right after a child of ours died that we lived in the devil's realm. But their kids were at my house all the time. So I decided that I was just going to be the little enigma in their lives. And I really do love these people, and I could tell you so many instances of weird things they said to me or did, but somehow we transcended it, and we focus on our humanity. Mm-hmm. And our children were very dear to each other, and even our kids have ended up in very different places from each other because of our different backgrounds, but we still really care very deeply for each other. I can have really deep conversations with both the husband and the wife, and I mean, I really appreciate them. I depend on them, and in your definition of family, they're part of my family.
They are. Awesome.
Marilyn Caldwell. I grew up as a twin, and twins have a special problem in that they don't know that they are individuals. And I fought that for a long time because I knew it, but my twin sister didn't know it. So, but when I got married, both times, I went kind of back to the twin pattern of not being myself. And after my second divorce, it took about 2 years of therapy to make me realize I always had been standing on my own. I didn't have to depend on somebody else. So that's the way it's been ever since.
Great, great.
It's about time. So why don't we all stand as you're able and join me in singing hymn number 311, Let It Be a Dance.
Thank you.
Who I am is due partly to who you are. I'm made by you, you're made by me. We are all who we are because of where we came from and who we spend our lives with. So let's enrich each other's lives as best as we can and join each other for coffee and conversation. Thank you.